We are examining in this sermon series the letter that Paul wrote to the church at Corinth. The idea is to learn to think God's thoughts and to see life as He sees it. The principal of our high school in Hopedale, Ohio, was a French-Canadian fellow named Baynard Turner. His fellow teachers nicknamed him Bud. Behind his back, we students called him Barnyard Turner. No particular reason, we just liked the sound of it. Mr. Turner was a little man, about 5'4". Earlier in his life, he had been a professional boxer. He had boxed about 20 bouts and had never been beaten. But then his own cousin, in a match, knocked him out. Mr. Turner quit professional fighting and became a high school principal. One Christmas season, Bud took his niece to see Santa Claus. The line was long. He stood with his niece in his arms, and he waited and waited until it was their turn to see Santa Claus. Just when he was next in line at the front, a bigger man than Bud crowded into the line ahead of him. That really irritated Mr. Turner. So, right there in front of Santa Claus and in front of the parents and children behind him, he tapped that man on the shoulder, and with one punch, Mr. Turner leveled that man on the floor, knocked the intruder out. 1 Corinthians chapter 9 is tailor-made for a generation of people who demand their rights and who are obsessed with power. We resent any attempt by anybody to deny us our rights or to deny us even our place in line, or anybody who dares to throw his weight around if it's in our direction. Power in our generation has become a very popular word, even a slang word. We hear about power wardrobes, whatever that means, power vocabularies, power lunches. What is a power lunch? Have you read about the seminar that can help you to eat your way to the top? For $6,000, you can attend this seminar, but for free, I will give you some of the highlights that I read about. And then you can start today to eat your way up the ladder of success. Never tuck your napkin into your collar. Never leave lipstick on the rim of the glass. Never stir your food. Never haggle over the bill. Never, ever hand your plate to the waiter. Never read the menu like you would read a Bible, as though it really mattered what it said. You're not there to eat, you're there to do business. Never ever stoop down to retrieve dropped silverware. That last one summarizes much of modern culture. Never stoop down for anything. Stooping appears weak and submissive. Never stoop to help anyone. Never lose your grip on the rung of the ladder. 1 Corinthians chapter 9 smashes to smithereens all that nonsense. The standards of Christian character and behavior are so radically different from our culture that Christians are constantly doing things that we are told we should never do. Last week we looked at 1 Corinthians chapter 8. There Paul explained that a Christian who has superior knowledge but does not love people is a liability to the church, not an asset. Paul concluded chapter 8 by saying that he loved people more than he loved meat. And he said that he was ready to give up meat forever. He would give up his right to eat any meat if eating meat was a spiritual problem for a weaker brother. That is not an empty boast for Paul. He meant that he would absolutely not, never again, ever in his life, eat meat if it caused a spiritual problem for anybody else. Such self-denying love for other people was and is uncommon. The Corinthian church couldn't understand that. This man is willing to give up meat forever. That made no sense to them. They couldn't imagine somebody doing that for anybody. So they began to judge and attack Paul's character. They figured nobody can be that nice. He's up to something. This is suspicious. This does not add up. We're being set up for something. But they couldn't imagine what Paul's scheme was because he had never asked for and he refused to accept any financial support from them. And that was strange. Why would he not accept their help? Corinthians chapter 9 is an illustration of the lesson in chapter 8. 1 Corinthians 9, Paul gives them a practical illustration of the strong lesson about denying yourself for other people in chapter 8. In the first 14 verses of chapter 9, Paul explained that he had every right to be supported financially by the Corinthian church. The Corinthians totally misunderstood why Paul always worked to support himself. Since he did not accept payment of any kind for his labor among them, it must be the only thing they could think of. If he won't take our money, it must be that he knows he's not a genuine apostle. He is not a legitimate preacher of the gospel, or he would accept a living wage. They all do. Paul was not only a legitimate apostle of Christ, he was the apostle who came to this city and established the church. He was the only apostle they had ever seen. Of all the people on earth, they should have known who he was. He converted them to Christ. He established the church. No one else could contradict the facts. The problem was, Paul never accepted money for kingdom work. He worked long, hard hours making tents to support himself. Any other preacher would have expected a salary from the congregation, but Paul refused any money. I remember in early years when I was working in the coal mine, preaching on the weekend, and then going to college. And life was hard trying to work full-time and trying to go to college full-time in the winter months and work and preach. And it was just difficult strain all the time. Paul lived that way for decades. When he wrote this letter, he was hundreds of miles away from Corinth in western Turkey. So, in order to solve the problem, in chapter 9, he helped the church to understand his situation by conducting a judicial examination of himself. The Apostle Paul put himself on trial. The charge for which he was being tried was self-denial for other people. Can you imagine that? This is a masterful thing that he has done. Paul cross-examined himself in such a way that the answers are obvious. He evaded nothing. He asked more questions than they would have asked of him. He probed deeply into the charge against him. In verse 4, Paul began the interrogation. Question number 1, do apostles have the right to be provided with food and drink and lodging? Well, of course they had the right for that. Do apostles have the right to take a wife along with them? And do apostles have a right to expect the church to support not only themselves, but their wives and their children? Well, of course, all the apostles did that, took their wives on their mission journeys. Even non-apostles, like the half-brothers of Jesus, who had wives, were supported by the people they served. So in verse 7, Paul expands the logic. He said, who serves as a soldier at his own expense? What man ever became a soldier, bought his own uniform, bought his own weapons, paid for his own transportation? Well, nobody does that. A while back when we sent soldiers from the United States to Desert Storm, we did not ask those young men and women to buy an airplane ticket to the Middle East. We did not ask them to buy gasoline for their tanks. We didn't ask them to buy bullets for their guns. So Paul said, let's expand this further into the everyday events of life. Vegetable farmers, men who grow vegetables for a living, do not go to Wegmans to buy vegetables. That's a paraphrase of what he said. Shepherds do not buy mutton at a meat market. It would be silly to think that Paul did not have a right to the support of the Corinthian church. The experiences of everyday life from every angle make it obvious that this man who labored among them had a right to be supported with the essentials of life while he was there. Verse 8, Paul continues the judicial examination of himself. The question in verse 8, is the practice of being supported from the fruit of one's own labor just a man-made idea? Absolutely not. The Word of God clearly states this principle, and he goes back and he quotes Deuteronomy. Moses' law said, the law of God said, do not muzzle the ox while he is threshing. You know, the laborer is worthy of his hire. So Paul said to them, did God write that about the oxen just to teach men to be kind to dumb animals? Or was God implying something about our relationship to each other as people? Well, God obviously was speaking about the affairs of men. Both the man who plants the crop and the men who help harvest the crop share in the benefit of the crop. Some have criticized the Apostle Paul and have done this for centuries. And there are many people who have always been out to get the Apostle Paul and to make him look foolish. Some have said, now right here, when Paul quotes Moses about the oxen, he uses the passage in an unhistoric way, and he rips it out of context, and he's trying to apply it to something else. Paul's critics said, God was talking about how you treat oxen and nothing more than that. And Martin Luther, years ago, came to Paul's defense with three words. I just love this. Martin Luther said, oxen can't read. I thought that was so good. Is it not obvious that the law of God is for man's benefit and that God is thinking way beyond how we treat animals? The bottom line is a worker has every right to participate in the fruit of his labor. That applies to all workers, whether man or beast, whether plowman or harvester, whether ox or apostle, laborers have a right to share in this. In other words, the laborer is worthy of his hire, period. Verse 11. Paul planted the spiritual seed in Corinth that produced the Corinthian church. And they were all now enjoying forgiveness and a relationship to God and the promise of heaven because Paul came and labored in their city. In return for that, would it be wrong for Paul to be given food, drink, lodging, a living wage? I mean, if a farmer is allowed to eat from his own garden, and if oxen are allowed by God's law to eat while they are threshing grain, is it not appropriate, Paul said, for a church to support those who brought the gospel to them? And Professor Christney said, there is something humbling and good in the fact that preachers need the help of those they have helped. And then Christney said, how a church supports those who serve them is a measure of their spiritual growth. I think I understand what he meant. One of the highlights of my life, and I don't say things like this to fill up sermons, but actually one of the highlights of my life is to see our church being generous with other people, with Christian workers. You not only are generous with Mike and me and our families, when you sent $12,000 to Africa to help build a house for the Dennings, I think I was almost as thrilled and thankful as Rob and Michelle were. I was so proud of you when you did that. I was so thankful to be a part of this fellowship. What you did for the Dennings, you did for Jesus Christ. What you did was right. It was beautiful. Paul had more to say about this principle of support. If he stopped right there in these illustrations that he's given so far, if he stopped right there, it might leave the wrong impression. So in addition to natural law and what nature dictates, in addition to legal considerations from the law of Moses, Paul now adds sacred consideration. Verse 13, he referred them to God's temple. God said that the priests who worked in the temple were to receive meat and money from those whom they serve. In verse 14, Paul added that Jesus himself had taught this same exact principle. When Jesus sent 12 men out to preach the gospel, and on another occasion, when he sent 70 people out to preach the gospel, do you remember what Jesus told them? Take nothing with you. Take nothing. And I'm sure they're wondering, what? You mean nothing? And Jesus enumerated. Jesus said, I'm sending you out to serve me. Do not take your purse. Don't take your wallet. Don't take any money. Take nothing with you. They were to be supported from those who benefited from their labor. Jesus taught this same thing. So Paul had proved to the Corinthians beyond a shadow of a doubt that God's will is that God's servants be supported by the contributions of believers. He had proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that he, Paul, had every right to their support. That's the first half of the chapter. And in the second half of the chapter, beginning in verse 15, Paul explained to them why he would never accept any support from them, why he was always going to refuse their help. That is amazing to me. And it wasn't anything personal. It wasn't like, your money's tainted, your money's no good, I wouldn't stoop to use your contract. It wasn't that. Paul wasn't trying to prove anything. It wasn't a put down, but he never took a dime from them, and he said he never would. He always supported himself. He not only supported himself in Corinth, he had supported himself at Ephesus by working with his hands. He had supported himself at Thessalonica. This was Paul's way. He was always supporting himself. Why would he do that? Well, he figured his case, his situation was different from everybody else's. Why not accept help of the churches? Well, not to prove he was a bigger man than that. He had one reason: to save the greatest possible number of people. His top priority in all of his life was to win people to Jesus Christ the Lord. If he accepted money for preaching anywhere, some critic would say, he's like all the rest of them, he just preaches for money. And somebody would believe that, and that would hinder him from ever trying to win them. Paul said he would rather die of starvation than to give his critics ammunition that would nullify what he was doing for Jesus Christ. Now, I know that sounds extreme, that he would die of starvation, but wait till he finishes what he wants to say. In verse 17, Paul explained his case was the exception. If he had chosen by himself to be a minister of the gospel, then it would be appropriate for the church to compensate him, and he would have something to be proud of if he had made this decision on his own. That was not what happened. Years ago, Mike and I became Christians when we were both young men. And later, after maturing somewhat and completing high school work and so forth, Mike and I decided that we would become preachers of the gospel. We made the choice to do that. And I suppose to some degree, our decisions are commendable. People have spoken to us to that effect anyway. That's not how Paul became a minister. For Paul, it was the reverse of that. It was not his choice. He had not decided that one day he would become a preacher of the gospel. In his case, what happened was the Lord and Master decided the whole thing without asking Paul's opinion. Jesus did not say, Paul, will you do this for me? Jesus said, Paul, I appoint you to be a minister of the gospel. I am sending you to Jews and Gentiles to open their eyes that they may receive the forgiveness of their sins. Jesus did not invite Paul to be a minister. Jesus said to him, do this for me. Paul figured that he had no right to a reward. He had no right to payment for his labor. His responsibility was to be a steward, a faithful steward. He was given a job by his master. Now, if Paul had chosen, like Mike and me, to be a servant of Christ, then you could say that would be to his credit that he made that choice. But that's not his case. He had been bought and paid for in his sin by the death of Jesus Christ. He had been singled out, called and chosen to be a steward slave, and slaves don't get wages. Paul would, of course, be richly rewarded by the Lord, but not because the Lord owed him anything. Any reward that Paul would receive would be to the credit of the magnificent generosity of God. It wasn't that it was owed. It's hard for us to think in those terms. We're so into, I deserve it, it's my right, I own it. It's hard to even understand this man in the second half of the chapter. Now, I know, Jesus told parables about slaves and masters, and Jesus said that sometimes masters rewarded their slaves, but that never really happened, not in real life. Jesus' stories were memorable and striking because they are in glaring contrast to what really happens. Slaves are to be faithful and do their job. When a slave did a job well, the master didn't thank him. He certainly didn't reward him. The slave was under obligation. It was his job. And Paul said, that's my situation. On the road to Damascus, Jesus ordered Paul to a task. As a slave of Jesus Christ, Paul obeyed without question. Jesus did not owe him anything. No payment, no reward, no credit, nothing. Jesus owed him nothing. He understood that. Jesus doesn't owe you and me anything either. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, but, you know, later on, the Apostle Paul wrote a letter to Timothy, and he talked about a crown of righteousness that was laid up just for him. That's true. Paul wrote that. And there was a crown, and it made his eyes sparkle when he thought about it. But the crown was nothing that Paul had earned. That was the outstanding generosity of the goodness of God. I mean, think about it. A slave with a crown? What are you talking about? Slaves don't get crowns under any circumstance. Who ever heard of such a thing as a slave wearing a crown? This is the astounding generosity of God. Paul's reward, as he saw it, he said in verse 18, My reward is to preach the gospel without charge. My reward is to preach the gospel and serve without support, without reward. It is an honor and a reward in itself to serve Jesus, period, if I never get anything else. Paul had learned from the radical generosity of Jesus how to be radically generous toward other people himself. So he preached without charge. He figured, this is one little way I can be like my Lord. I'll do this without charge. Nobody paid him. So Paul established church after church after church, and he asked absolutely nothing in return. And in my opinion, I would say that the Apostle Paul was a very generous person, and his generosity is to his credit. That's what I'd say. Paul wouldn't agree with that. He did not want to be credited with generosity. What he wanted was to win more people to Jesus Christ. That's what Jesus told him to do. That's what he lived for. He was a free man. Earl read the verses. Free of all men. But he made himself a slave to everybody in order to win more of them. Martin Luther said, a Christian man is subject to nobody, but he makes himself subject to everybody. Paul was free, and he made himself a slave. He could not be bought. He could not be bribed. But he would serve the churches freely in order to gain more men and women. That's pretty focused, wouldn't you say? I read that news commentator Dan Rather has a sign sitting in front of him on his desk all the time. The sign says, how is what you are doing right now contributing to tonight's broadcast? I'd say he's probably pretty focused. He evaluates every conversation, every article he reads, every phone call, every lunch break, everything he does, he evaluates to see if it is contributing to his goal. That's the Apostle Paul. He knew that receiving money from the churches would give some devious person a chance to accuse him of preaching for money, so he supported himself by hard manual labor, and that gave him more credibility to win more people. You ever read the Bible and agonize? Lord, I know I'm not that focused. I know I'm not like this man. I still guard my comfort zone. I wish I could win more people. But that is a price to pay that's expensive. Would you deny yourself to help more people go to heaven? 5 years ago, we asked you to. 5 years ago, the leaders of the church asked you to inconvenience yourselves and to divide yourselves into two groups, because at 10:30 on Sunday morning, this room was getting so full, there was not much room for visitors. It was awkward sometimes. You couldn't sit with your own guests. So 5 years ago, we asked you to divide up, and some of you come at 8:15 at a much earlier hour, and some of you at 10:30 to create more space. And you did it. And I never heard any complaints. And since that time, for 5 years, some who are in public responsibilities here on Sunday and some who work behind the scenes are week after week after week here, 5 and 6 hours every Sunday morning of their lives when they're in town. And our church is stronger. And we preach the gospel and worship with more people than ever. Thank you for inconveniencing yourselves. Did you hear about the London transportation system? This was in the news. They boasted that the buses of London, England maintain a flawless schedule and run like clockwork. If the schedule says a bus will be at a particular location at a certain time, it was there. Unfortunately, many buses were driving past bus stops where passengers were waiting without stopping for the passengers. And the buses were nearly empty. They had room, but they went flying by. Well, within 2 or 3 days, the people were complaining and calling the bus transportation department. So the transportation department sent out a memo to the newspaper and the media. It said, "It is impossible for us to maintain our schedules if we have to stop and pick up passengers." I couldn't believe it. That's what it said. We can't be on schedule. We have to stop for all these people. Boy, they operate like clockwork. The goal of our church is not to run a smooth schedule. I mean, it's nice when we have a smooth schedule and things are on time. We start on time, we quit on time. Things happen appropriately. I mean, that's desirable, but that's not what we're trying to do. We are trying to pick up all those people who need to get on board and go to heaven with us. The Clarence Church of Christ is a part of the body of Christ. And like Jesus, our purpose, our goal, our mission is to seek and save those who are lost. Paul was willing to forego a smooth course through life for himself and to suffer the discomforts of laboring day and night if that makes the road smoother for somebody else to know the Lord. So here's what he did. To the Jew, he became as a Jew. Never compromised the teachings of Jesus. But in matters of personal preference, when he was with Jews, he did what Jews do. And he ate kosher food. He went with them down to the synagogue to worship, stuff like that. You know what that did? That caused a good impression. They liked him. They respected the fact that he respected them, and they liked him. And he taught them about Jesus. To those people who lived under the law of Moses, he complied with how they lived every time he could in good conscience. He didn't work on the Sabbath day. He kept the Ten Commandments. He showed respect for their convictions, so they showed respect for him, and he taught them about Jesus. To those who were without the law, the Gentiles who didn't have a law from God, Paul was sympathetic. When he was with them, he was working at being like them. Now, he didn't break the law of God. He didn't join the thief in his stealing in order to identify with anybody. But Paul accepted them as they were, and he loved them. And because he did accept them, they became friends, and he taught them. To the weak, he became weak. Paul figured if Jesus loved people enough to die for them, he could love people enough to accept them as they were until he could show them a better way. So why did Paul deny himself, push himself, make himself a slave to everybody? Verse 22, to save some, at least some. Even an apostle with supernatural power couldn't save everybody he met, but he could at least save some. And what a joy and what a happiness there is in a person's heart when you have been party to bringing somebody and help them to go to heaven. Paul was very focused, did everything in his life to help somebody meet Jesus. I still work on that. I'm not good at that. I miss lots of chances. I think about it after the fact and think, oh, Jim, if only you had, and whatever. Do you remember the 7th grade boy who had cancer and had to be taken out of school, of course? He underwent surgery. He had chemotherapy, lost all of his hair. Every hair on his head was gone. It was going to be tough on the fragile ego of a 7th grader to go back to school with no hair. He dreaded it. First day back, stepped into the school building, right inside the door. 6 kids from his class, each of whom had shaved their heads so he wouldn't be embarrassed or be singled out. How do you become all things to all men? What's that mean to you? To what extent would you not be you and what you want, what you feel, what you like for somebody else? I know a Christian guy from out of town, a friend of mine, who himself had a friendship with an unbeliever, and he wanted to help his unbelieving friend to become a Christian, but they didn't. So the Christian guy asks the non-Christian, "What do you do for fun?" And the non-Christian said, "I lift weights. I go down to the gym every night after work." So the Christian guy said, "Sure, I'd love to." Is that a lie? No, I don't think so. What he said was, "For the sake of the gospel and to help you know the Lord, I'd love to lift weights." So they lifted weights together for several months, and their biceps grew and their friendship grew. And after months, the unbeliever said that he wanted to be a follower of Jesus Christ too. After the Christian baptized his friend, the Christian guy said to him, "I'm glad you're in the Lord's family now so I can get out of the gym." He didn't want to do that anymore. Which reminds me of Jesus eating with Pharisees. I don't think that was necessarily always enjoyable. Some crowd of people. Jesus spending time with, having encounters with tax collectors, rough people, prostitutes. Can't believe that was always enjoyable, but he did it because he loved them until they would listen. The Apostle Paul cared about one thing, the right to be heard. He knew he had to earn their friendship. He had to earn the right to be heard. That meant different things to different people. He would be different things to different people. So he loved the irreligious, the immature, the unbeliever, the legalist. He loved them all. He loved them enough to give up his wages just to be sure they didn't have miss a chance to know Jesus as Lord. Paul wanted to go to heaven. He buffeted his body. He denied himself his rights. He practiced rigid self-control just to be faithful to the call of Jesus. When Paul woke up in the morning, his first thought was, "How can I be useful to God today in fulfilling this mission, spreading the gospel?" That wasn't his thought on Monday and Thursday evening on calling night or some scheduled program. When Paul woke up every morning, it was, "What can I do? How can I serve my Lord today?" Do you ever ask yourself the hard questions like, "What am I doing here? Why am I here? Why am I in Western New York? Why did God see fit to bring me into the 20th century? Why was I born? What's my life for?" And the Bible is the only place you'll ever find an answer to questions like that. There are two possible outcomes to your life. You can win or you can lose. Our choices determine whether we win or lose. For me, for you, Western New York is our proving ground. It's time to take control of ourselves and our lives so we won't lose. Are you a Christian? Do you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God? Do you believe that? His word to you is to repent of your sin and to be baptized for the forgiveness of your sin, of everything you've ever committed or done. Can you hear him calling? 369, I can hear my Savior calling. Will you turn there with me? 369, and stand with me now, and let's sing the first verse and chorus together, please. 369.